It is Tuesday, July 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the Washington Post reports intelligence officials say North Korea is constructing new missiles. The United Nations condemns a civilian hostage taking by Islamic State in Syria, and we meet some parrots at a store in Virginia. It's all ahead. Military officials from North and South Korea met Tuesday at the border village of Panmunjom in a renewed effort to build trust amid a thaw in cross-border relations. The two Koreas have agreed to discuss reductions in weapons and military personnel along their demilitarized zone, or DMZ. The talks took place as a senior U.S. official said satellites have detected renewed activity at the Sanumdong facility that produced the country's first intercontinental ballistic missiles, even as the U.S. pursues denuclearization talks with Pyongyang. The Washington Post, citing identified officials, reported Monday the North appeared to be building one or two new liquid-fueled missiles. Bruce Bennett is a senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the North's motivation is unclear. Either it's simply pursuing activities it has engaged in the past, or is deliberately pursuing activities it knows the U.S. will see as a way to extract further concessions.
The North wants an end to the economic sanctions against the North, and so they may be sending out images in a way that they're hoping will push the U.S. to make more compromise.
In June, U.S. officials told U.S. media outlets intelligence agencies believe the North has increased production of fuel for nuclear weapons, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said as much before the U.S. Senate just last week.
Yeah, the North has learned over the years that the more threatening the situation in the past, the U.S. has been more prepared to make a deal and compromise. The problem, of course, is that President Trump isn't necessarily the past president. If he gets pushed too hard, that could turn out bad for North Korea, and they may not be adequately recognizing that.
Generals from the two Koreas met Tuesday at their shared border for talks meant to ease tensions and the military standoff. This comes as the North repatriated, we're told, a number of American remains from the Korean conflict. How is the denuclearization process going, in your view?
I think we haven't seen much in the way of denuclearization. I mean, if you were to rank the facilities that we would be concerned about, the ones that North Korea has talked about and done something about, the nuclear testing facility, a launch stand for a missile, those would be at the bottom of the list. They would not be of significant interest because here's North Korea producing more fissile material and producing potentially more missiles. It's the production facilities that we want to get under control, and there's no movement on getting those under control. There's also no movement on reducing the nuclear weapons or the missiles themselves. And the North had said at the end of last year that their program was mature. So for them to destroy a couple of test facilities when their program is, according to their own statement, mature, that's no big deal. They're not really giving the U.S. very much at this stage.
Bruce Bennett of the RAND Corporation. He said the latest developments should cause some concern within the Trump administration. He said since North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's charm offensive began in January, the North has not denuclearized but continues to nuclearize, adding to its growing arsenal of weapons. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. There are no plans for U.S.-Iran talks at the ASEAN meeting. A Turkish court rejects an appeal on a U.S. pastor's house arrest. President Trump ridicules key Republican political donors, and suicide bombers raid an Afghan government office. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. Telephone inventor Alexander Graham Bell is credited with the saying, "When one door closes, another opens." The saying could also apply to two of NASA's key exoplanet hunters, Kepler and TESS. After discovering about 2,650 confirmed exoplanets, NASA says it expects the Kepler spacecraft to run out of fuel in the next few months. NASA also announced that its new exoplanet-hunting spacecraft called TESS, or the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, recently started its science operations. The new spacecraft will send freshly gathered data to Earth every 13 and a half days, with its first transmission expected sometime in early August. NASA says soon after this initial set of TESS data arrives, its scientists will begin to search through the information to see if the spacecraft spotted any new exoplanets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, tension and celebrations, but no results the day after pivotal elections in Zimbabwe. The UN Human Rights Office is condemning multiple attacks by Islamic State militants against civilians last week, which reportedly killed and injured more than 200 people in the city of Sweida in southwest Syria. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
The UN agency reports scores of Islamic State militants went on a rampage, raiding homes in at least 8 villages in rural Sweida, shooting and killing civilians, and abducting women and children in their homes. Human rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says her agency has the names of at least 27 women and children reportedly taken hostage. She adds the real number is probably much higher.
Photos of some of these abducted women were later tweeted, with threats to burn them alive if the government did not cease military operations against ISIL in Western Daraa and release ISIL women and men who were in government custody.
Shamdasani says many of the militants reportedly were recently evacuated and relocated from the Palestinian Yarmouk refugee camp and other areas of southern Damascus as part of a so-called government reconciliation agreement. While agreements putting an end to fighting are welcome, she tells VOA the government is obliged under international law to make sure that civilians are not put in danger.
They are duty-bound. They are the state who have de jure power, who have jurisdiction over this area, and they have the duty to protect civilians who are in this area, including by not putting them deliberately in harm's way by putting ISIL fighters close to these civilian residential areas.
Shamdasani warns against transferring armed fighters who have a history of gross human rights abuses in proximity with local communities. She says their presence in all likelihood will increase violent attacks against the civilian population. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Celebrations erupted in the streets of Harare Tuesday as opposition supporters mark what they said was a certain victory in Monday's pivotal poll, the first in 38 years without longtime leader Robert Mugabe on the ballot. But official results have yet to be announced, and observers and the Electoral Commission have raised concerns about aspects of the campaign. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Harare.
A flurry of emotions as Zimbabwe breathlessly awaits results of a pivotal election. On Tuesday afternoon, opposition supporters took to the streets of central Harare, celebrating what party leaders said was a resounding victory in Monday's poll, despite a lack of official results from the Electoral Commission. The poll was effectively a race between President Emmerson Mnangagwa and opposition challenger Nelson Chamisa. However, the celebration was tinged with menace. A VOA reporter spotted 5 water cannon trucks, each loaded with police, making their way through central Harare, just a block away from the celebrations. Although results had not been announced as of Tuesday evening, the two main rivals have already aired their views on social media after Monday's poll. Chamisa tweeted Tuesday morning that his party was winning resoundingly, based on results they had collected from most of the more than 10,000 polling stations. Party official Tendai Biti.
We have now received from our agents across the country results of the 2018 election. the results show beyond reasonable doubt that we have won this election and that the next president of Zimbabwe is Advocate Nelson Chamisa.
Also Tuesday, Mnangagwa urged caution on Twitter, urging Zimbabweans to exercise responsibility and restraint by patiently waiting for the ZEC to declare the official outcome. But he noted, the information from our reps on the ground is extremely positive. All this talk, the largest local observer mission said, is worrying. The Zimbabwe Election Support Network on Tuesday praised the poll for being smooth and peaceful, but network chairman Andrew McConey said such political sniping and rule-breaking could tarnish the election. On Monday, the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission said it had reported two presidential candidates to police for campaigning outside the allowed window, but the commission declined to name them.
One of the main issue which really is of concern to us is the issue of hate speech in the period leading to elections. It's something which the political players from across the political divide must work on. Again, you saw that when ZEC indicated that campaigning was going to end by 12 midnight on Saturday, we saw campaigning continuing on social media. We saw pressers being held. We also saw the president of ZANU-PF also appearing to continue with this campaign on Facebook, which was also broadcasted, I understand, on ZBC. So those issues are of concern to us. If we want to make our election management board look credible, we also must respect in some way their pronouncements.
Lawrence Mandara, a political science lecturer at the University of Zimbabwe, says this is a delicate moment for Zimbabwe, but added that the people showed maturity and a desire for calm. If anything happens, he says, the population won't be to blame.
I'm not sure how Zimbabweans will react to the results, but knowing how Zimbabweans are, they won't take that route. If there is any violence, this violence will be sponsored by those candidates who would have lost. But in terms of the people, I don't think they will go that far. Our political culture in Zimbabwe is one which is non-violent. The violence has always been sponsored by politicians, not by the people. So any violence that will come as a result of the outcome should be squarely a blame laid on the politicians themselves and not the people.
Final results are expected by August 4th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Harare.
In Cambodia, the ruling party says it has won every seat in parliament. Sunday's election was slammed by rights groups as a sham because the main opposition party was banned. The Cambodian People's Party said it now controls all 125 seats in the National Assembly. CPP figures show voters' second most popular choice was to spoil their ballots, despite the government's threats against those considering using their constitutional right to boycott the election. Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen is now set to extend his already 33-year reign by another five, free of any real opposition party. Late last year, the CPP's only real opponent in the election, the Cambodia National Rescue Party, was dissolved, and its leader, Kem Sokha, jailed on widely derided allegations it was fomenting an internationally backed plot to overthrow the government. Joshua Kurlansik is Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. He tells me his reaction to the election.
Cambodia wasn't a democracy before. It was sort of something of a flawed hybrid regime, but now it's become a full-on autocracy run by Hun Sen, the prime minister. I mean, I think it means there's probably going to be some degree more repression, and there's no real blocks against Hun Sen. I'm not sure in practicality it changes that much, since Hun Sen was in a fair degree of control before, but it definitely further limits the scope for any sort of limitations on Hun Sen's power.
And what about the state of the opposition? So many opposition leaders are now in exile, if not in prison.
Yeah, many are in exile in prison, or some, there are some still in Cambodia, but they're especially in terms of civil society opposition leaders, but they're scared. I don't have one good answer. It's possible Hun Sen will try to co-opt some of them, which is something he's done in the past, and sort of restore some degree of normalcy and slightly more open environment. It's also possible that he sees this as like the determining year, the determining time, and this is just going to become an all-out autocracy, and that their options would be to try to rally street protests or some sort of aggressive sort of, I don't want to say violent, but some sort of aggressive non-street or non-ballot box type repercussion and response. But right now, the opposition is pretty much shattered.
Kem Lay, who was an activist 2 years ago, was assassinated. Before his assassination, he had been very critical of Hun Sen, particularly because the organization Global Witness had put out a report saying Hun Sen's family was worth a minimum of $200 million. Considering what has happened since, and I believe an investigation was supposed to take place regarding that killing, but nevertheless, when you think about what has happened, I mean, does this mean that Hun Sen could, he and particularly his family moving forward, try to accumulate, extend power, say, into the next generation and continue to accumulate more wealth?
Well, I think that there was an investigation into the killing, although the question is that they placed the blame on a man who seems unlikely that he was behind the killing, and there are some even questions about his mental capabilities. Yeah, I mean, I think Hun Sen is probably potentially preparing to try to hand power over time to one of his sons and or others in his family, yes.
Before the latest election, there were a number of media organizations like Voice of America, also Radio Free Asia, that their websites were shut down. It was impossible for people in Cambodia to view them. I mean, it does seem, again, that the government of Hun Sen is really limiting the access of its citizens to a free media.
Right. Well, I mean, VOA and RFA were just part of a broader campaign against free media, which included forcing the closure of the Cambodia Daily and really seriously undermining the Phnom Penh Post, which were two important and independent media outlets, as well as forcing the closure of a number of opposition or just simply independent radio stations in Cambodia that provided an alternative to state news. So all of those things together definitely suggest that Hun Sen has decided to dramatically try to limit people's options for accessing news. I don't know if he's going to be successful in the long term because Cambodia's internet is still relatively more free than some of the most repressive states in the region, but he's definitely trying to curtail independent news outlets.
Joshua Kurlansik, Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Small or giant, expensive and rare, a pet store in Falls Church, Virginia, has dozens of parrots and anything one might need to take care of them. Maxim Moskalkov paid a visit to the store that specializes in the exotic feathered friends.
Yeah. Parrots, 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 just parrots. It is clear what this small bird store in Falls Church, Virginia, sells. The room is filled with dozens of bright-colored parrots, from chatty cockatoos to giant macaws.
Hello.
Two tiny parakeets. Store owner Ed Willis got his first parrot when he was 18 and never spent another day without one. Willis says parrots make wonderful pets and get very emotionally attached to people.
It's a unique partnership between a parrot and a person. They're independent, but they're still needy. They're happy to see you when you come home. It's a really special pet relationship.
The store first opened its doors in 1988. Today, it's one of just two shops in the D.C. area that specializes exclusively in parrots.
To be honest, I feel a little uncomfortable right now.
And this is not because I'm afraid of birds, but because the parrot that is sitting on my shoulder costs almost $17,000.
The hyacinth macaw is a rare bird. There are only 6,500 of these parrots left in the world. This bird is just a few weeks old and has a long life ahead of it. Just like kids, this parrot loves affection.
So from the neck up, they like to have their feathers ruffled. You can see, and she'll even put them up herself. And then from the neck down, they like you to smooth them. Come on, baby. Hey, come here.
Willie's arms are covered with claw marks and bites, the price of keeping big birds.
Well, they're not really trying to hurt me. Sometimes it's just playfulness, and sometimes they're scared or they fall.
The store is a busy place. Parrots attract housewives and school kids, businessmen and doctors.
My daughter is a huge parrot fan, so we come to visit the parrots a lot since we don't have any.
But not all the birds at the store are for sale. Some have become family.
So Snowball is not really a typical cockatoo. He's actually very quiet and very friendly. A lot of the cockatoos are known for being extremely loud, and he has not been. So a lot of people are interested in this bird.
Willis got Snowball when the bird was tiny. Today both the store owner and his daughter Kelsey are really fond of him. And looking at how comfortable Snowball looks perched on Willis' shoulder, it becomes clear the bird couldn't imagine a better family.
That's so good.
Maxim Moskalko for VOA News, Falls Church, Virginia.
Look at life with parrots. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Terrorists like to travel. Terrorist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda depend on travel, said Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism Nathan Sales to Transatlantic Alliance partners at a recent conference hosted by the German Marshall Fund. They have to travel to receive training. They have to travel to case their targets. They have to travel to carry out their attacks. Every time they board a plane or cross a border, we have an opportunity to detect and capture them. When ISIS attempted to create a physical caliphate, an unprecedented number of foreign terrorist fighters, roughly 40,000 people, flocked to the war zone in Syria and Iraq. And now that we've liberated some 98% of the territory ISIS once held, there's a risk that some of these battle-hardened veterans will return home or relocate to third countries. To identify terrorists or suspicious persons hiding among international travelers, the United States uses PNR, or passenger name records, to search out those who may pose a threat and should be prioritized for additional screening. PNR is information provided by passengers and collected by air carriers for enabling reservations and carrying out the check-in process. In December 2017, the UN Security Council unanimously adopted Resolution 2396, which, among other things, obliges all UN member states to develop the capability to collect, process, and analyze PNR to limit terrorist travel. The United States applauds the passage of Resolution 2396 and is prepared to help other countries implement their obligations to develop PNR systems. So we will continue to push for fast and full implementation of Resolution 2396 and to highlight the value of PNR. We will also share our PNR system with any country that wants it. And we will work with the International Civil Aviation Organization to establish appropriate standards and recommended practices for PNR. The United States and the nations of Europe are strategic partners on virtually every major issue of the day. Indeed, more than partners, allies, and friends. Nowhere is this transatlantic synergy more apparent than in our joint struggle against global terrorism, said Ambassador Sales. We share the same values, we share the same interests, and we share the same enemies. In short, we're in this together. There's a lot of work ahead of us in the fight against terrorism. Only by facing it together can we win.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.